remember that this is explorations in condensed matter. So what we want to do here is to bring you closer to real, well, nowadays, real research. And so this third week is very close to real research. I have to confess that in the previous 2 weeks, I had a hard time. I had to, for the first time in my life, diagonalize free fermions and also do exact diagonalization. I had never done that. But today, well, this week I'll be telling you about things that I'm more familiar with. So so I want to tell you about these tensor networks. And the first thing I want to do is start motivating why you should or you may care about tensor networks. And so the first thing I want to say is that this is now established as a language, as a natural language or formalism to efficiently describe many body ground states. So what we're saying here is that we may want to talk about a wave function, and you know that it takes exponentially many coefficients, exponentially in the system size. But what we're going to develop here is a formalism where you basically specify some tensor as given by some, some tensor, maybe a collection of tensors. But maybe the nicest formulation is when you have translation invariants or scale invariants in your system, and you can exploit it. And then you end up just giving one tensor that completely specifies your ground state, okay? In some sense, that will become clear later today. But the idea is that instead of going crazy about many, many coefficients, we have a finite number of coefficients independent of the system size. We can even take the thermodynamic limit and study systems without finite size effects, et cetera. Okay? So it's we want to talk about a new way of writing many-body quantum mechanics. The second is that point is that tensor networks provide insight into the structure of entanglement in many-body systems. So if you take as your goal to understand how the different parts of a many-body systems are connected, and this might be relevant in order to understand the phenomenon of emergence and so on, then it turns out that entanglement, that the tensor networks are directly an expression of this structure of entanglement, okay? We build tensor networks thanks to understanding how the different parts in a many-body wave function are connected. Third point is that one of these tensor networks and has, well, turns out to be a formulation of the renormalization group. But it's a modern formulation of the renormalization group. It's non-perturbative as opposed to using perturbation theory. Okay, so and it's real space as opposed to momentum space. And so if you think about quantum field theory, what they tell you is, here's quantum field theory. I define my field. I have an action. And then we start doing perturbation theory in momentum space. That's what you do when you start computing Feynman diagrams and so on. So what we have here is a chance to change this. Okay. Nowadays, tensor networks are generalizations to continuous systems. And the hope is that within the next few years, we'll see a reformulation of quantum field theory in terms of tensor networks, where there is no momentum space invoked at any time, where there is no perturbative treatment. So forget about the need to be close to an exactly solvable or free theory. OK, that's big. And then finally, the original motivation. We started this because we wanted to be able to solve the Haber model. We're still trying to solve the Haber model, but well, maybe we're closer. We have now variational wave functions, powerful variational wave functions that allow us to describe efficiently these many-body states. And therefore, we can now energy minimize. So take the Hamiltonian, try to lower the expectation value by the Hamiltonian, and find better and better approximations to the ground states. Okay. So this last point is the original one. And what we are asking is, given the Hamiltonian, can we find the ground state? Okay. That's the original question we wanted to answer. Excellent. And then.
Just a couple of questions down the road. Is this method applicable to find only the ground state, or in principle, you can classify somehow the excited states as well?
So this is a matter of, it's very easy to make big claims, and I'm good at making big claims, but in practice, we are way more comfortable describing ground states. And then you have to, so progress is being made, especially in one dimension. Hopefully this will jump to higher dimensions on describing excitations, local excitations on top of ground states. So there is a lot of ongoing research in this direction. So it's not just, indeed, just the ground state, but also nowadays in one dimension, we can find the dispersion relation for generic systems, lower energy states as well. Okay, but there is no hope that we will be able to describe an arbitrary state in the Hilbert space. We know that that is not possible. It's also not clear why we would want to describe a generic excited state in the whole spectrum.
So on that note, do we expect low excited states to obey similar things like error laws or boundary laws?
Yes, they actually obey the same principle. So you can think of them as you take the ground state, which obeys this boundary law, and then you create some excitation somewhere. And at most, you have to take a linear combination of that excitation being created here and everywhere else. Mm-hmm. So that adds entanglement, but in a way that you can still just describe the wave function the way I said. You just think of the ground state with an excitation and then translations everywhere else. So that's still, you know, translations, you have order n of them. So this is still an efficient representation. Mm-hmm. All right. So let me start by reviewing something we mentioned briefly the other day, which is this diagrammatic notation. I'm going to be using it all the time from now on. So remember that we choose to represent a vector as a circle with a leg. So this would be some vector matrix. Mij with circle with two legs and so on. So we should tell which index is which in general, but hopefully it will become clear from the context. And so in general, you'll see, and I'll be using today, tensors with an arbitrary number of legs. So for instance, here I could say this is I1, I2, IN. This could be the tensor that I use to represent the wave function, the ground state, of a system with n sides. Okay? And I think I already told you what that represents. Do you know what that, do you remember what that represents? It's a number, right? Could be zero, but it's a number here. So this is some complex number. All right? And then remember that we also had tensor multiplications. And that if you see something like this, you see, oh, this is a vector, which is the result of matrix times a vector, and so on. Okay, so if I want to compute the expectation value of an observable, okay, if this is just a single vector with on one side, then I would do something like this. But if this was the expectation value of a wave function that on n sides, then you'll see some drawing like this. This is psi, n sides. Then maybe this observable is acting only on one side. Right. So you'll see a diagram like that. That's an expectation value. Okay. And if we want to divide it by the norm, then we'll just draw something like this. Well, it's not the norm, but the norm square. So I will leave it like that. Excellent. So let me define these tensor networks. So I'm going to consider a lattice. With vector space, which is just n copies of some site of dimension d, small d. Okay, and then I consider a wave function, which on this space, which I can always expand in terms of a local basis. Okay. And so I'm going to introduce tensor networks by just drawing something. And hopefully, after a bit of explanations, it will become clear what this means. So I'm going to try to write the wave function, the whole wave function, this tensor that has d to the n coefficients. Okay, I'm going to attempt to write it as the product of smaller tensors. So here's an example. So that would be a tensor network. Now, what are we looking at? So let me first say that there are two types of indices. I'm going to call the open ones physical indices. Okay, there are n physical indices, and they are the same on both sides, right? And then we also have Born indices. Okay. So each tensor can have maybe a combination. This tensor here has a combination of a physical index and three Born indices. This one only has Born indices, and so on. Okay. All right. So the important aspect here is that if we want to consider a larger system, on this side we will add one index, and this will bring us dimension to the n plus 1, right? So we have exponential growth of the dimension. Whereas here, if we wanted to add an extra side, we would just extend the tensor network like this. Now, why is this interesting? Well, let's count parameters. So I already said that here we have a number of parameters which is exponential in the system size, in the number of sides. Whereas here, I'm going to assume that there are some number of tensors that are order n tensors, okay, and that each tensor has some number of coefficients. For instance, if we look at this one, it will have some number. If each Born index takes, say, runs from 1 to some largest value chi, then this guy here has number of indices, which is chi to the 3, right? If you have three indices, each one goes from 1 to chi, then there are chi to the 3 complex coefficients stored in the tensor, okay? But the important thing about this is not that this is a large or a small number, but that this is independent of n, okay? Independent of n. So what we're saying is that each tensor has a size that is independent of n, and therefore we have that the total number of coefficients is still order n. Okay, we go from exponentially many coefficients to a number of coefficients that only grows linearly in the system size. Is that clear? Okay. So let me give you examples of tensor networks during the week, we'll see the real examples. Now we are just going to deal with fake examples or examples which are very simple and they don't have a lot of use in practice. But they help us understand what's important about the other tensor networks that we will discuss. So the example number one would be a trivial tensor network. Suppose that we want to represent the state that happens that we can describe as a product state. Okay? So imagine that your wave function factorizes as the product of states for each single site or spin in your system. So what we're saying is that psi I1, I2, IN is equal to psi 1 component I1, phi 2 component I2, phi n IN. So if I wanted to represent this as a tensor network, I would have to draw a vector. This is a vector of components, right? Every guy here is a vector. So my tensor network will look like this. That's maybe the simplest tensor network we can think of, where there is some Born index, if you want to think about it, but this Born index only takes one possible value, right? So if you have a matrix, and the so suppose you have a matrix which is, I don't know, 3 times 3, right? Alpha, beta. Now, if you have another matrix where, say, beta only takes one value, you fix the value of beta, then this ends up being just a vector, right? If we fix the value of beta here, we get a column. So you can always think that there is some Born index, but takes dimension 1. So it's a trivial Born index, and we don't need to draw it. Okay? So this is maybe the simplest tensor network we can think of. But of course, we want to go beyond this simple example. And the next example The next example will start from a product state, which I'll choose to be just 0, 0, 0, 0. And I'll consider a quantum circuit that makes this state evolve. So imagine we start with a state 0, 0, 0. And now we apply a number of gates. So after this, the final state is no longer a product state. The final state is some entangled state psi of the n qubits. We're going to assume that we have n qubits here. And the depth of the circuit is going to be t. Capital T is the number of gates, of rows of gates that you have here. Okay. So this is an example of a tensor network where we have that our state down here is obtained by multiplying together tensors. In this case, each tensor has 4 legs, and it's a unitary gate. All right, so we could go on drawing tensor networks, but instead of doing that, I'd like to try to give you an idea of what it is that we look, what makes a tensor network useful. Right, so 6.4 properties. Okay, and I've tried to summarize this into just 3 properties. First one is that it has to offer an efficient specification. What does this mean? It means that I want to be able to completely specify the many-body state using a number of parameters that does not grow exponentially in the system size. And typically, the ones that we'll find most useful are those where the number of parameters that we need to specify is just order n, linear in n. But of course, we could also be happy with n squared or any polynomial. But in practice, the ones that we will see this week are all order n or small corrections on n. Okay? And we'll have a look now in a second with those two examples. So the second thing, which is different, is that we want to be able to efficiently manipulate it. Efficient manipulation. So what we mean by this is that we want to be able to efficiently, say, optimize this tensor network so that it minimizes the expectation value of the energy of a local Hamiltonian so that we can approximate the ground state, or we want to be able to efficiently compute expectation values. Okay, so for instance, optimization here, I want to be able to look at minimum over the tensor network of the expectation value of the energy as a means to optimize the tensor, as a means to approximate the tensor network, or so that the tensor network approximates the ground state of this Hamiltonian, or I may want to be able to efficiently compute, say, the expectation value of sigma x on site 32 as a step towards computing the spontaneous magnetization or whatever. It's not enough that I can efficiently specify the state. I also want to be able to extract information from it. Okay. And finally, perhaps the most important property, of course, is that it provides a good approximation. To ground states or whatever type of state that you are trying to describe. Okay? There is no point in having something that is very efficient if in the end it's not a good approximation to what you wanted to describe in the first place. And it's very hard to assess whether a given tensor network will give us a good approximation. That's very hard. But there are necessary conditions that a tensor network should fulfill. And this has to do with how entanglement scales and how correlations scale. So here I'm going to focus mostly on scaling of entanglement. And also decay of correlations. Okay. We'll see that depending on how you put the tensors together, this tensor network will in a natural way have some scaling of entanglement and also of correlations. And so if you say you want to study some critical system in one dimension and you expect a power law decay of correlations, you expect the entanglement entropy to scale as the logarithm of the size of the region. And if you use an ANSET that is not capable of reproducing these scalings, then you are probably not going to, you are not likely to find a good approximation to the ground state. Okay? Good. So let's have a look then. Are there questions? Yeah?
I have a question about the notation. In the case of loss index of or legs of tensors are cross, is that make different, different from without?
Right. Cross? So what happens if you had something like this? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, if we're dealing with bosonic systems, that won't make a big difference. If this was a fermionic system, then this crossing would imply changing fermionic degrees of freedom. So there might be a conditional minus one coming out from here. But I'm not going to discuss fermions this lecture. So for bosonic degrees of freedom, when the microscopic degrees of freedom are bosonic, I won't pay too much attention to changing the order of the indices in a tensor. All right. So let's go back to the example number one. We had this product state, still somewhere up there. And you actually dealt with these variational ansatz during a tutorial with the Ising model. So let's look at how efficient it is. Let's look at property A, efficient specification. And we just saw that you can specify it by just telling me the state of each site, right? So if each site is described by the complex parameters, then you completely specify this product state with n times d, which is order n, so we are very happy there. Okay. We have order n parameters. We can deal with very large systems. If we were to enforce translation invariance, then we would just need to specify one of those, right? So this will be there all the time. If we have translation invariance, then we go to just d complex parameters or order one in terms of n. Okay, so b, efficient manipulation. What we want to ask here is, for instance, how hard it is to compute the norm of the state. But this is nothing but the product from n to from 1 to capital N of phi n, right? You take the scalar product of this state with itself, you find that each factor multiplies the corresponding factor in this way. Or if we wanted to draw this using diagrams, then we would find that we have this just n times. And so this can be accomplished again with order n operation, right? I just need to multiply this times this, this times this, this times this, and then multiply them together. That's order n steps. Similarly, if you want to compute the expectation value of, say, the energy, so assume that the energy breaks, well, I'm going to assume that the energy is sum of nearest neighbor terms. And this then, I'll just take one element of the sum, psi h I j psi. Then you realize that you get basically the same as before, but somewhere you have a two-body term. Okay, so this guy is hij. And you see that you can compute this expectation value by, again, multiplying these products and then restricting your attention to very small matrix or tensor multiplication, right? And if you count this, then assuming that you have already normalized the state, each factor here gives you one, so we can remove them. And we're left with this, just this simple calculation. And this calculation here, well, the computational cost does not depend on the system size, right? So it's order one. But now we have to do this for all the terms in the Hamiltonian. So assuming short-range Hamiltonian, there are on the order of n different Hamiltonian terms that you have to evaluate. So again, we can efficiently compute the energy with order n calculations. OK? And once you can compute the energy, the expectation value for the Hamiltonian, then you can see how to minimize it. You can try around with the parameters that you have in each of these vectors and see how what you need to choose in order to lower the energy. Okay? Excellent. So this is a very simple case, and then there is a catch, which is that it's also not very useful, right? So it's not completely useless, but still, it's not the. It has a very clear limitation. So the limitation it has is that it's not capable. This variational ansatz has zero entanglement. Okay. So when we look at entanglement, scaling of entanglement, so now we are part C, scaling of entanglement. Then how does the entanglement of a region of size, linear size L, scale with L? Well, in a very simple way. There is zero entanglement. You can see this because if you compute the reduced density matrix for any number of sites, it's still in a pure state, right? So Reni entropy or von Neumann entropy equal to zero. Now, what about correlations? Well, similarly, you can see that let's see which notation I use here. That if you take this state and you look at the correlator for any observable among two sites I and I plus L, then this factorizes. So this is very clear. If you use the proper expressions, you will end up with phi I O I phi I. And phi I plus L O on site I plus L phi I plus L. And this factorization is telling you that the connected correlators are zero. Okay? All the connected correlators are this minus this. So if you want, right? So connected. Let's put it this way, I plus L connected is equal to this, and it's equal to zero. There are no correlations in the system. So, you know, this is the simplest option we have. Now, I have to say this is still very useful for certain types of phases, especially symmetry breaking phases, where it is OK to have at least to get the first estimation of a phase diagram between symmetry breaking phases, you can do what we did during the tutorial. Remember, in the case of the IZ model, we had some magnetic field here. For the magnetic field equal to zero, we found some, well, the phase diagram, if you put here the magnetization, if we have here the magnetization, we would see that it goes like this, that there are two branches, and then this is the critical point at h equal to 1. So it turns out that the true ground state right here at 0, and so this ground state and this ground state, and also in the limit of large h, these are the ground states are product states. And so this ansatz would be perfect, would get the exact energy. And in between, it may or may not get the right thing, but we have already identified the two phases in the phase diagram using just a product state. Of course, another question is whether you will know that you have the right answer, right? But a product state is the basis of mean field theory, and it's not completely useless. It gets you a first idea of a phase diagram at a very, very simple cost, very, very low cost. All right, so let's now try to get away from this product state. So the problem with the product state is that it has zero correlations between the sides, zero entanglement. So the quantum circuit, a tensor network that we described before, is a way of going away from that. Okay.
So, but I have a question. Does the zero correlation and zero entanglement are the same? I mean, well, for
zero correlations and zero entanglement come from the same, from the simple fact that it's a product state.
So suppose it's not a product state, then these two things are not.
They measure different things, but you would have, again, you could have zero correlations and a lot of entanglement. It would mean you are looking at correlations for local observables. You could have zero correlations there due to having massive amounts of entanglement. You remember the numerical experiment we made. If you pick up at random a state in the Hilbert space, it was very entangled, right? Actually, if you look at the reduced density matrix for one or two sites, it's going to be completely mixed. So if it's completely mixed, it means that the expectation value of any observable will be uncorrelated. Any two-point observable will be uncorrelated. So you could have a lot of entanglement, as a result of which you would also have zero correlations.
So what about the other way around? Say I have correlations, but I don't have.
There is no way you could have correlations and no. If you have a pure state,
then it's always like
right.
Zero.
The only place where you don't have entanglement is a product state, which has no correlations, right? So if you have correlations, then it cannot be a product state. Therefore, it's entangled. Right. No. What I said is wrong. Anyway. All right, so let's go back to the quantum circuit. So that was example two. And there, remember that what we have. You can think of this directly as a generalization of the product state. Here, I'm putting 0, 0, 0. But I could have written phi 1, phi 2, etc. Because, and then just absorb it in these gates, right? So if I had so any other phi, if I here I had phi 1, that would be 0 plus some unitary gate, but I can absorb it down here, so I don't write it. Okay, so this is this includes the product state that we just analyzed, and it goes beyond that. It adds the possibility of having some amount of entanglement. So let's see. Property A, is it what's this? Let's count how many parameters we're going to need here. So I'm saying we have n sites, n quantum wires, and then the depth was t. So this means that we have on the order of t times n gates, right? And if each gate takes some number of parameters, so it's d to the fourth power, right? Each gate has four legs. Each leg has a d-dimensional system, so d to the fourth power. But this is independent of the system size. So the total, so therefore, it takes order t times n parameters to completely specify the resulting state down here. Okay, so this is good. If t is small, say t is constant. Here we will consider a case where t is constant. Okay, and then this becomes order n. Okay, so it's by specifying order n parameters, again, we have built a many-body wave function. And this time, it will be entangled. It will have correlations. All right? So let's look at efficient manipulation. Can we compute the norm of this? And here I tried to get some work done before, but it was a bit of a mess. The blackboard was wet. So let's compute the scalar product, right? So what we want to do is we want to draw the bra and the cat. And these drawings are all included in the notes that you can find in the wiki. So let me be the one stressed out drawing things. So what we want to do, see, this is the cat, this is the bra. We want to compute their product. So we're going to trace over these indices. But now what we have is this is some unitary gate, and this is a join. It's complex conjugate, right? Hermitian conjugate. So we know that U dagger is equal to the identity, right? So as soon as we see this, we know that it goes away. This one goes away with this one, right? And this happens for all the gates pairwise in this first row, right? They are annihilated pairwise. Nice mess. And then this gate is exposed to this one, and they are also Hermitian conjugate. So like, all the gates go away. Okay? And finally, you are left with. So you can remove all the gates, and you're left with the product state we started from, but this is equal to 1. Okay, it was normalized. So computing the norm of in this tensor network based on a quantum circuit is very easy. It's done. We don't need to do it. It's, the norm is 1. Now let's look at how we would compute, so no cost, how we would compute the expectation value of a local observable. So imagine that this is here the observable. It's a one side observable, maybe magnetization. Again, it could be sigma x or whatever. Okay. And now what we see is that, again, there are many cancellations possible. This is U, and this is U dagger, right? So they go, again, they go away, right? And this happens also here and here and so on. And then you go to the next row of gates, and you can delete many of them again. But there are a few gates that you cannot delete, right? Because this is U or some unitary, and this is U dagger, another unitary. The same unitary with a dagger. But you cannot, but there is something in between. There is an obstruction. So we cannot annihilate them. Pairwise. And the same happens to this and this. And so, and then you realize that there is some causal cone here, some gates that you cannot delete. Okay? Same thing here. I mean, this is the result. You are left with this diagram. And now, in order to compute this expectation value, we would like to evaluate this tensor network. Remember, there are zeros here, 0, 0, etc. Also here. So this one and this one gives us a multiplicative one, which goes away. Same thing for all these lines. But we're still left with this mess. And when you try to evaluate this, you realize that you have to build a tensor in intermediate steps. The best way we know is to build a tensor with a number of legs, okay, that depends on the width, the largest width in this causal cone. So if you try to compute this, you will end up building some big tensor with many legs. How many legs? Well, it will depend on the largest width here that we have. But this is proportional to t. If this was t, then we go up here in the, on the order of 2t. We'll have the number of legs that we have up here. So we'll have to build a tensor that will have on the order of t or 2t legs. But this implies that the cost is exponential in t. Okay? In trying to evaluate, in trying to extract information from this tensor network was very easy to deal with, to specify order n times t parameters. But when we try to extract information from it, when we try to see what, learn properties about the state it's representing, then we see that we have to pay a very high computational cost. Okay? The cost is exponential in t. All right? Great. So if we want to compute correlators, well, yeah, I'm going to leave that here. So this was for the computational cost. And the conclusion is that it's exponential in t. And now, finally, so let's see. Specification, good. Computational cost. Bad. Okay. And finally, let's look at whether this could be a, what this could be a good approximation to. Okay. So for that, again, we look at entanglement and at correlations. Okay. And if we look at correlations, let me look first at correlations. For correlations, what we want to do is to look at some observable on site I, some other observable on site I plus L. Okay. And this amounts to drawing the quantum circuit for the Brahm, for the ket. And again, this is in the notes. So I'm going to put the operator I here. This is site I. I'm going to put the other one here. And hopefully, one, two, three. Yeah, that should work. So remember, we would put all the gates, right? And then we would be left with some causal cone of gates that don't go away. And same thing here. On both sides. Okay. So the starting point, and of course I have zeros everywhere up here, and brass zero also everywhere down there. So this is after I've simplified the diagram by annihilating pairwise every pair of unitaries that were exposed. And I'm left with this. And now, if you look at that, this looks exactly as what we would obtain if we wanted to compute. Remember, these lines can go away, right? There is 0, 0. All these lines can go away, also this one. And this is nothing but the product of one quantity which you can identify quickly as the expectation value for the observable on site I times the expectation value for the observable on site I plus L. Right? So again, the connected correlators vanish after some distance. So if this point had been closer, then the two causal cones would have connected, and I would not have been able to factorize this number. But what we're learning is that as far as correlations are concerned, so this, if I call this C of L, then C of L is equal to 0 for L larger than some number, which is, again, on the order of 2 times t. Okay? So for sufficiently large distances, we have zero correlations. And for shorter distances, for L larger, smaller than 2t, this may be finite, some nice function of L. Okay? So we might be able to capture correlations very well within small distances, and there are no correlations left at larger distances. OK, that's correlations. Then we can look at entanglement. And to look at entanglement, I'll use some result that you will learn more in detail this afternoon in the tutorial. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and build explicitly the reduced density matrix for a block of L sites. So let's try this. Rho is equal to, what do I do? So this is rho for part A of the system. And this is nothing but the trace over some part B of psi psi. Yeah.
Question. So usually in condensed matter systems, correlation functions either decay exponentially or algebraically. Right? So why is this,
ground state useful? Since, I mean, the correlations are a little bit weird, right?
They're weird.
So
you don't like these answers?
No. I mean, I'm saying up to what point is it useful to use this?
Well, when you have decay of correlations that say is exponential, it means that after 3 times the correlation length, the correlations are negligible. I mean, you have to decide what you call negligible, right? So this fails to reproduce the scaling of correlations. But being extremely positive about things, you can say, well, but I'm getting the local properties correctly, perhaps, right? So then you might be happy with that. We'll be more demanding tomorrow. We'll demand that we have an ansatz that where the correlations decay exponentially. So let's try then to draw to compute the reduced density matrix, and from this graphical calculation we'll extract some conclusion about how the entropy scales. We'll see that the entropy saturates to a constant. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw the circuit for psi dagger. And then I'm going to trace out a number of sites. And I'll be left with some sites. This is the reduced density matrix for those sites. Okay, this is what I want to do. But instead of being happy with drawing a circle, I have to draw this circuit. Okay. That's what I want to do. So look at your notes, or wait for another 15 minutes, and I'll be done. OK. So I'm going to open a gap here. And this corresponds to the sites that are not being traced out. OK. And then I have to draw all these gates on top. And here, the complex conjugate, and so on. Now, I would draw the gates here, but you know what's going to happen. They'll annihilate, right? So I'm just going to remove them directly. And I'm left with only the causal cone for the region. So I would have to draw all this, right? Now, after t steps in this direction, there are no more gates, right? So you can see that here we have 0, 0. All the gates in between have disappeared. So after drawing these lines, the next natural step is to remove them again. OK? I'm removing all this. Same thing here. I can remove all these lines. And then it turns out that we conclude that there are, let's see. Let me draw this in detail because they're going to be important. What we have in the end is that there is a number of gates, of lines connecting the bra with the cat. The upper part with the lower part. So if we look at this, there are a number of lines, 1, 2, 3, and 4, that connect the upper part with the lower part. Same thing here. In this case, for some reason, I get only 3. Actually, only 2, because this one should go. So let me think about this one. Yeah, this one should go as well. So I find 3 on this side and 2 on this side. But that's circumstantial. If I want to increase, what's important is that this number of lines does not depend on the width of the region, right? If I consider a larger region, I would also find two or three lines here, two or three lines on this direction that connect the upper part with the lower part. So what this means is that after doing all this manipulation, I got to the conclusion that the wave function, that the density matrix can be written in this way. see we have a number of legs, open legs, L of them here, which now I draw down here. We have these open legs down here. Blue is not a good choice. Purple. These open legs corresponding to the size that I have not traced out, which are up here. Okay. And now, if I look at the legs that connect these two parts, there are 2 and 3. Okay. So just from looking at this, this is the density matrix I'm interested in. I've done a number of moves around. Remember, the nodes are should be more clear. But the important part is that I can write the density matrix as an object that is connecting branchet by means of a finite number of legs. And this automatically implies, tutorial this afternoon, that the entropy of rho, okay, of rho part A, is at most log D, the amount of entropy each leg can provide, times this number of legs connecting the upper part with the lower part. Okay? And this number of legs, you can convince yourself that as you consider a larger region here, it's on the order of T. There are only T such legs, okay, on both sides. So this, again, this number of legs is on the order of 2T. Okay? On the order of 2T. So T gives us the distance after which there are no correlations, the distance at which the entropy saturates to order 2T. Okay? So, and believe me, if we had, I can take some criticism here. This drawing is not the nicest drawing I've drawn in my life. But try to prove this, you know, with equations. And then what I'm saying is that it's very, very convenient to be able to use this diagrammatical notation. Okay? If you had to write this in equations, you would get lost with all the indices. Whereas by just drawing it, it becomes clear that it's a problem of connectivity, how many lines we have from the top to the bottom. That determines, that gives you an upper bound to the entropy that we can have, as discussed further today in the tutorial. And therefore, we can conclude from here that the entropy saturates for large distances to a quantity which is 2t times log b.
So last week, it's very different, the scaling for 1d than 2d, or so on. In this case, these tensor networks, where is this information about the spatial dimension codified?
This tensor network has been, this answer, we will try to say that it's a good answer for one-dimensional systems. Okay. For gap, it's kind of good answer. You could repeat the same in two dimensions and have a quantum circuit where the wires are distributed in two dimensions, and then time is a third dimension. And you would get nice scaling there as well. So you would get a boundary law for entanglement entropy. OK, so it's time to conclude. So what we've seen then is that the entanglement, in this case, saturates to a constant, as given by order T, and that the correlations go to zero after a characteristic length scale, which is also so for L larger than order T. So now if you want to, you know, show some mercy to these ansatz, you could say, well, it might be a good approximation to ground states of gap Hamiltonians in one dimension, okay, where you want to enforce that T be larger than the correlation length in the system, right? If we had a finite correlation length in the system, remember that that then as a function of L, if we plot the entropy, we expect that roughly at the correlation length in the system, the entropy would saturate to a constant. Also, if you compute, so this would be for the entropy. Also, if you compute correlations, then you expect an exponential decay where after some distance on the order of the correlation length, the correlation has decayed significantly. So let's take now, let's accept, or if you are willing to accept that correlation, say, three times after the correlation length, these correlations are negligible, if we accept to replace them with a zero, then you may say, OK, I'm going to try these ansatz as a good approximation to the ground state. But what's the problem then? Well, remember that the problem is that the cost is proportional to t. So what we would have, sorry, it's exponential in t. So we would have that the cost is exponential in the correlation length in the system. Okay. So if you're willing to pay a cost that is exponential in the correlation length in your system, you might consider using these ansatz, this tensor network, to represent ground states.
What happens at criticality if I want to see ground state of a critical Hamiltonian, then I have to pay an infinite amount of computational cost, right?
That's the point. That you can, if you think that you are very close to a zero correlation length wave function, to a fixed point wave function, or a fixed point in the RG sense for a gap phase, then this is a significant improvement with respect to a product state, right? So you did this for the ISI model. You had an exact, when you used the product state, you had an exact wave function in both extremes of the phase diagram for zero magnetic field and for infinite magnetic field. This will allow you to cover more than that, right? And this is important for several reasons. One of them is if you had not known that the ground state was a product state in some limit, then using just the product state as variational ansatz would have given you some energy, but you wouldn't know if it's the right one or not. Now you can expand on that. You can add some entanglement to the wave function. And if you recover exactly the same result as in a product state, then you know that the product state was giving you the right answer. Okay? So this is not completely useless, actually. It allows you to expand on mean field theory, if you want, on assuming a product state, right? But with a cost that is exponential in the correlation length. So tomorrow, starting from tomorrow, we'll see how to overcome this and have a cost that does not depend essentially in the correlation length. But that will be tomorrow. Yeah, that's it for today.